Are we ready?
Are you ready?
I'm never going to be ready. Come on, you got to go with me.
I'm going to hold your hand.
I want you to maybe pick me up and carry me.
I could probably
you
do
could
that.
Probably.
Where is it? Substation MOXE, broadcasting to you from the swamps, jungles, boondocks, and infected salad of Fort McCourt. Home of the fighting 1st Platoon of Hungry Eye Company, 3rd Battalion, 3rd Marines, defensive perimeter, just north of the rock pile and just south of the demilitarized zone of Vietnam.
It's inscribed Michael A. Baranowski, Pennsylvania, Lance Corporal, Company 1, 3rd Battalion, 3rd Marines, Vietnam, August 6, 46 to November 29, 66. I am Alex Baranowski, Michael's younger brother. I am the only surviving son of the Baranowskis.
I'm Lorraine. When I was a child, Mike referred to me as Cookie.
Hello, Mom, Dad. This is your friend and mine, me. Freedom Frog here at World War 2.5. Five of us managed to get into Da Nang earlier in the week, and we just took a liberty on our own. First one we'd gotten since we've been here, and I managed to find a tape recorder. So from now on, we'll be able to send tapes along with letters.
This is my brother. When I look at the photos of Mike on stage, that's the Mike I relate to.
He was quite accomplished as an actor. Plays, drama. He loved the drama club. He loved the people in the drama club. The people in there were very intelligent. His IQ was off the chart. There, at that time, there was no way to measure it, and no one knew. He was just an overachiever, highly intelligent, and he needed to be stimulated. And, of course, school didn't cut it. He was obviously smarter than his teachers.
We wander through the jungle hills of Vietnam all day. We find the Viet Cong and chase them far away. You'll find no finer fighting men of any name or sort. You'll always find us ready here on top of Fort McCourt.
When I see him as Captain Von Trapp in The Sound of Music, that was my image of my big brother.
And he quit school his 6 months into his senior year to join the Marine Corps.
This portion of our programming is brought to you by 20 Round Burst, the candy bar voted best tax waste of the war.
My name is Tim Duffy, and I knew Mike Baranowski in Vietnam.
Raymond Borowski, Jr. My relationship to Mike, we were in training in Okinawa and eventually made it into Vietnam for what we had to do there.
It looks so much like play there, doesn't it? I don't know. I see a grown-up boy posing for a picture. Mike is in a uniform holding a gun, a pistol. I don't know much about guns. And looking off into the distance with the gun out like he's playing cowboy and Indians.
Last night we had a patrol trip, an M-26 fragmentation, set up as a booby trap 2 feet off the ground. And we had three Marines medevaced last night and are on their way home to the States today. None of them were killed. Anyway, there's a new program, or whatever you call it, where the minute you're hit over here, you're taken right from here by helicopter through the battalion area, and as soon as you can get medical attention, you're on a plane, which is a direct plane now, straight to the States, and then you're transferred to a jet that goes straight to the nearest military hospital to your home. It's almost enticing. When rounds start coming in, you're almost tempted to stick your arm up there, you know, and wave it around, hoping to catch something.
These pictures belong to Tim and Ray and Mike. You know, this was their world and what they remember and understand.
I'm in the hooch now, where I bunk. With this new job as captain's bodyguard, I'm in here with wiremen, communications men, code experts, things like that, rather than 0311s and the grunts or the infantry, whatever you want to call them.
At that time in my life, I was a lost teenager in some ways, and I didn't know what I wanted to do. I knew that eventually I was going to be drafted, and I wasn't going to let that happen. I quit high school. I wanted to join the Marine Corps and popped my bubble when I was at the recruiter because they looked at me and they said, it'd be nice, but you're a high school dropout. We can't take you. So I had to take my folks' signature to get me in, which they were reluctant, wouldn't do. It was on Christmas Eve when my dad and I went to visit my grandmother, my dad's mom, and it was just before we were getting ready to leave. My dad wanted to know what to bring her for Christmas. And she told my dad that she's going to give Pa a Christmas present. That was my grandfather. And she looked at my dad, and she looked at me, and she pointed at my dad, and she said, let him go. I'll watch him. And with that, naturally, my dad was a little choked up and told him, you know, don't talk like that. And it was about 12:30 in the morning on Christmas morning that we got the phone call that my grandmother passed away. And December 26th, my folks and I went on down, and they signed for me. And she did watch out for me. She's still on my shoulder.
And lots of people on our block that we knew were there or preparing to go there or had enlisted. And he didn't want to wait to be chosen and positioned somewhere. He wanted to volunteer. I think he had something to prove that he could be like anybody else.
The picture in the paper of the graduating class looked really wonderful. I wish I could have been there to see Sandy and Pam graduated. I wish I could have been there with them. But it's not a great loss. It's not a loss that I feel, really. This is where I belong, I think. More so than any place else. I don't know. It's difficult to explain. Maybe I can do a better job on another tape sometime.
I don't think Mike felt a need to prove anything to anyone. I think that Mike had come to a point of maturity, and he had come to a place of peace in his ability to express that, a sense of independence, long before he went into the Marines. He, according to my mother, felt an obligation to be a part of the Vietnam War. When he went into the Marine Corps, it was his intent to volunteer to go to Vietnam, and he did follow through on that.
And now a brief word from your local League of Pacifists.
You'll be sorry, baby.
It took her at least 20 years to forgive herself because she had to sign papers to allow him to leave high school and go into the Marines. But she also knew that there was no other alternative. He so strongly wanted to do this.
I enlisted in the Marine Corps in late 65 and went to boot camp in March of 1966. After boot camp and infantry training regiment, we were shipped to Okinawa, and Mike had been in country at that time for about 4 months with India Company, 3rd Battalion, 3rd Marine Division. They pulled out of country, went back to Okinawa, and we basically reinforced some of their losses from their 4 months there.
At the tone, the time will be 0:30.
I was sitting on my cot at Camp Schwab in Okinawa, and about six or seven cots down to my right, I saw a guy who I knew was one of the old-timers. I knew he was not one of the newbies with me, playing with a tape recorder. And, of course, at that time, being a newbie, you know, we're a little nervous about walking up to the old salts, and so I would have never approached him. But I watched him playing with a tape recorder, and he fiddled around a little bit, and then he turned the tape recorder on, and I heard what sounded like a full-scale battle. I sat there thinking, this guy is nuts. Literally, I thought that at some point during his first 4 months in Vietnam, they had walked into this hellacious firefight, and while everybody else is locking and loading and shooting, he's sitting there with his tape recorder recording the battle.
I heard strange sounds, noise, giggles, laughs, so I wanted to go see what it was, and sure enough, Tim Duffy was there, and he introduced me to Mike.
Ultimately, after we got to be good friends, I learned that an entire battle was all basically faked. He had done all the sound effects. He had done the machine guns, the rifle fire.
So, you like my sound effects, huh? Well, I have to put together a couple of feet of those for you sometime when I have the time.
He would fill a canteen half full of water and take a metal bayonet. He would turn the microphone off, hold it right next to the bayonet, tap the side of the canteen, and real quickly turn the microphone on, then back off again. And what you basically had was the sound of a ricocheting bullet.
He was one that did his best to keep the morale up for everybody else, and I think that was a way of keeping his own morale.
But first, a word from our sponsors.
This is Dale Robertson here to tell you, and there's my cigarette. It's a fine-tasting cigarette. You light it on either end, break it in half, and you got two little ones. Pellmell's my cigarette, and my horse likes them, too.
Mike was dubbing and mixing on a rinky-dink little 1995 tape recorder in Vietnam and putting out these humongous productions.
I think it was because of him that quite a few of us got tape recorders. I remember going to the PX in Okinawa, and they were out of them. I didn't get mine until I was on ship going over to Vietnam. And we went over on the Iwo Jima, and that's when I first bought my first one and made my first tape. And ridiculous as it sounds, and sent home to my folks with the tape recorder so they could hear my voice. Unlike Mike, my tapes were just verbal letters, short, sweet, to the point, don't worry about me, we're okay. Where Mike got more in depth with things.
I'm aboard the USS Iwo Jima. We'll be debarking very shortly in a couple of days. I haven't taped in the last 2 months, Miss Baines, because I've been lost. I've been lost and forgetful and inconsiderate. After giving it a little thought, I've come to the conclusion tonight that the state of Pennsylvania had every right to keep me in their cracker factory there. I can't figure myself out, and I can't figure out much of anything. Here, Miss Baines, this is my friend Tim Duffy. He'll tell you about the ship and stuff.
Life aboard ship, I suppose that's a rather hard topic to discuss. Basically, it's a monotonous routine, day in and day out the same thing. I don't know if Mike is the same as I am, but I know he's quite intelligent, and I'm sure that this nickel and dime games of classes that we've had a dozen times and such is very frustrating to him. I'm sure it is, as it is to me. Our evenings, I know Mike's evenings are usually spent either with a tape recorder or with a letter, trying to occupy the mind. Oftentimes we'll sit down and just talk. We've discussed everything from politics to religion to war and peace.
My mind contains no more than this tape does. I know. I'm just very dissatisfied with the world because I don't understand it, and very dissatisfied with everybody. You and my mother, and The only person that doesn't piss me off right now is my brother, I guess. Because he doesn't know what he's doing either. He really doesn't care. And that's no way to be, but it helps a lot.
The fear was very real every day. No, it was not exciting. It was around you all the time. It was in the atmosphere every day. Hours of it every day on the news. What hill was taken, how many people were killed, how many bombs were dropped, how far did they move toward the DMZ, who was killed that day, who was killed in the area. They would announce the names on the television. You know, your area and your county, you lost so many people today, and here are their names, and some were familiar.
My reality was that I was 13 or 14 years old, and I was very consumed with being 13 or 14 years old. The Vietnam War to me was the 6 o'clock news that came on after the Merv Griffin show, which we all watched after dinner. It had no basis of reality for me. It was a film clip.
Watered concrete here in New York, now switching you to your favorite foreign correspondent and mine, Johan Cameron Swayback in the Republic of Vietnam.
Mike invented characters. Mike invented his own insanity. It was innate to him. And so he created news broadcasters. One of his favorite broadcasters was Watered Concrete, which was obviously a takeoff on Walter Cronkite, who was the preeminent news broadcaster in the United States at that time. Another creation of his was Johann Sebastian Swayback, John Cameron Swayze.
This is Johann Cameron Swayback here in war-torn Vietnam, the land of 1,000 untold tragedies. I'm here near the DMZ at a typical United States Marine Corps patrol base. You there in Lincoln Green, are you playing Robin Hood or are you a Marine?
Si, senor, I am a United States Marine.
And what's your name, please?
Senor, my name is Manuel Labor from Mexico City, Mexico.
Oh, Manuel, what's your job here? What do you do?
Oh, senor, I am looking for the enemy.
Manuel, how can you see anything crouching so low in your hole there? When was the last time you looked out?
Oh, senor, I looked out, 10 minutes ago, and there was no one there.
Manuel, don't you think it'd be wise to take a peek maybe just once in a while?
Oh, senor, if you say so, I will look. But I was up there not too long ago, and I just know that there was no one.
I didn't understand, like I would today, my mother's concerns. She was very worried. She was wringing her hands daily, wondering, and I remember saying, is he warm? Is he dry? You know, is he getting enough sleep? Is he well?
Mom, your letters are just wonderful. I'm just glad you can find as much time to write as you do. Only wish you could find more. I just can't tell you what they mean to me. So good to hear from home, hear how everybody is, and just to get the letter, just to have it here with me, and know that everybody's doing well at home. It's so great. So please keep them coming, and know that I'm doing my best to get letters and tapes out there. You'll probably get more tapes now than letters because it is a lot easier and a lot just easier all around to tape.
I forget who bought the tape recorder, or maybe one was given to us by somebody from the school, one of the audiovisual guys. My mother decided to send a tape, and Mike liked that. And I think that started the taping relationship rather than the written relationship.
Hi, Mike. It's Cookie. I came in to say a few words of hello to brighten your day. Well, I'll see you, Mike.
And I appreciate you sending the money home, Mike, but I just
doesn't seem right for me to spend your money, so I opened an account, and I'm putting the money that you sent home to me into the bank for you when you get home. I wish that you could be home for Christmas. That'd be the greatest thing in the world.
He sent me probably a couple months' pay, and it was more money than we had ever seen in his 60s and more money than I had ever made. We used to write back and forth, and he always told me that stay interested in automobiles, and that's what I like to do. I always wanted to do something like that. He had sent money home and said, achieve your dream. So I, in fact, did buy a new Pontiac in 1968 with the money that I saved.
I don't want to spend too much time on the morbid aspects of this thing, but anyway, I think it's interesting, if morbid. And this is pretty good. This is, you know, the H&Is, which is harassment and injury, that's fired out of here each night, usually doesn't pick up casualties, but when it does, it's a good thing, something that they're always trying for, and if we can get them while they're out there wandering around in the middle of the toolies, that's fine. We could get them right there, and we don't have to wait until they sneak up to the hole and slit somebody's throat or something like that, you know.
I was adjusting a carburetor on my very first automobile, which was a 57 Plymouth convertible, and we actually were taping what we were doing. We described what we were doing and described what we used, and I thought that he asked us what were we using, what kind of tools, so I sent it to him.
It's funny that all of our H&I fire here from the hill is all dependent on a screwdriver. They have to have a little screwdriver there in the motor pit so they can set the increments on the side of the motor round so it'll detonate at a certain height, or whether they want it to explode at ground level, and it's accurate within seconds of the time they set it to. So they didn't have their screwdriver, and so I offered the little screwdriver on Sandy's penknife, and they were able to set the increments. And that just happened to be the night that they got seven of them. So Sandy's helping us win this war, too. Hey, I've got some news for you. No more PFC. I made meritorious Lance Corporal today. How about that? Proud of me? Just went down in the bunker today. Lieutenant Kimball called me down. Lieutenant Kimball's our CO now, until, I guess, another captain comes out, or maybe permanently, I don't know. Anyway, Lieutenant Kimball called me down, and I thought he had another sheaf of papers to be taken into battalion rear. Those coughs don't signify a cold, by the way. It's just too much smoking, I guess. I've been puffing like a Norwegian freighter. It's about the only diversion there is over here, unless you're a stargazer like I am, which takes up part of your time. So I wandered down there, stumbled down the stairs, and walked into the little crypt, and he handed me one single sheet of paper, which I've mailed to Pam, and she'll probably get that thing the same, you know, same I got when I was promoted to PFC on Pilots Island. Wow. You see that shooting star now? See that? There. It was a big shooting star just now. Sal. Yeah, Sal. Same. Sal is star in Vietnam. Vietnamese. Anyway, the lieutenant handed me the paper and he said, congratulations, Lance Corporal Baranowski. And I didn't know what to say, so I didn't say anything. Finally mumbled something like, thank you, sir. He said, any time, and that was it. So I have another meritorious racked up, and maybe I can make corporal before my 2 years is up. That would be nice. And now I'm qualified to be a fire team leader instead of just a regular rifleman. And that was mortars. They just fired maybe 40 feet in back of me. They fire every night, H&I. I guess I've explained all that jazz before. This is so much easier than writing. You get all the right voice inflections, and I can do it in the dark, of course, which is nice, except that this damn red blinker here is liable to get me zapped, so I've got my hand over it.
We left the USS Iwo Jima like October 28th, spent a week in Dong Ha on a little hill near Dong Ha, and then went up to Payable on November the 8th of 66. And Payable was a finger of a hill that came down out of the mountains, the southern edge mountains near the DMZ. It wasn't part of the DMZ, but it was close. And this long finger came down, and then on either side of us was what we called the Rock Pile and the Razorback, two huge mounds of granite. And we basically dug in. You know, our first week or two was literally nothing but digging and digging and digging, fighting holes and building sandbag bunkers and command posts.
We have a place to sleep dug. We have a fighting hole dug. We have a trash pit dug. We have a head dug. We have a grenade sump dug. All kinds of goodies. Feel like a mole now, and I look like one too. The sound you hear in the background is one of the many resupply choppers that have been coming in for the last 3 days. A 6 minute interval, it seems. It's been almost one continuous din of the roar of helicopter engines.
Mike was on one side of this long, long finger. I was on the opposite side. On my side, we had lots of trees and jungle and rain. On Mike's side, there were no trees, no jungle. It was all sawgrass. But what we basically did for the first weeks was dig our fighting holes like 4 feet deep, maybe 3 foot back to front, had a mud bench, and then a grenade sump in the floor that if a grenade landed into the fighting hole, theoretically, you can kick it into the sump and it'll fall down and explode and won't hurt you. Sandbags over the top.
We had the same setup here. Have a foxhole in front of us with two laws, 3 grenades apiece, 2 hand looms. How much up on the sandbags here? Our other squad of 1st Platoon is set in back in that jungle down there. We have 106s, rockets right up in back of us here, machine guns to our right and to our left. Quite a setup.
And cutting fields of fire. Now, that's simply referring to the fact that for X number of yards or meters in front of your fighting position, you have to have a clean, open field of fire. So you're cutting all the sawgrass so that for maybe 50, 60, 70 yards, nobody can hide in the bushes. We would run several layers of triple concertina all the way around, and that is basically circular barbed wire, 2 side by side, then 1 up on top. Set out hundreds of claymore mines, just all the paraphernalia, the baggage of a defensive perimeter.
We have a valley about 200 feet below us to our front, and then rolling mountains just a little beyond that, and then out beyond the rock pile is what looks like the Swiss Alps. Really something. All it lacks is snow-capped peaks and Hannibal with his elephants.
You worked your fighting hole in shifts, usually 4-hour shifts, starting at like 8 o'clock at night, 8 to 12, 12 to 4, 4 to 8. So one night you're getting 4 hours sleep, hole watch, 4 hours sleep. The next night you're getting hole watch, 4 hours sleep, hole watch. So every other night you're getting 4 hours sleep.
And India, and I believe it's Mike Company, right, Bill? Are the first 2 Marine companies officially, that's officially, this far north so far in the Vietnamese conflict.
And then, you know, daytime, you know, daily patrols. You'd leave every morning, 1 platoon or 1 squad, whatever, would leave every morning and go on a 6, 7, 8 hour patrol down through the villages or maybe back into the mountains, and then back that night.
A lot of walking. When you weigh about 150 pounds and you got 70 pounds of it on your back, you're doing a lot of humping, and one of the bad guys pops off around as a sniper. As much as you don't think, because you can't think, you have to get to the ground and look for cover. It's hard hitting the ground, and then you got that extra weight coming down on you, too. But that's besides the point.
Send the tapes now, because I have the recorder here, and I'm going to try to keep it elevated off the ground and away from everything here. I'm going to try to keep it up in the air, because everything I touch here eats through my skin or bites me or rots something. This is something else. The grass will cut you. The mud will rot your skin if you leave it on you too long. Yeah, Bell has ringworm all over his face, the back of his head. This is something else.
You would end up on a day patrol like every fourth day. Every night they had to have listening posts, and nobody wanted to be on a listening post. A listening post was real world suicide. Three guys, 150 yards out in front of the lines. Night squad ambushes, so real world. You were probably doing one or the other every other day.
You can probably detect in my voice the first stages of double pneumonia. I'm trying to cultivate it so I can get out of this hole.
So those were the official duties. You know, there was some free time during the day once all the bunkers were built and everything was done, and that's when Mike and I would get together and play with our tape recorders.
When you got the chance, you could go visit with the guys that you knew from weeks before, because you did click a little together, but it was a very short visit because you had to get back to where you were at. When I had time, I would go over the hill. I got caught a couple of times because I wasn't supposed to be in the area, so naturally I had to go on back, but it was something that I wanted to be around because of that little group.
And the reason why we loved him was that mind kept us from being bored, kept us entertained, and never permitted us to sit around and feel sorry for ourselves.
It's later in the evening now, almost dark. Every night we have a team leaders meeting. We go up, and after the lieutenant has passed all the good scoop to the three squad leaders in first platoon, each squad leader passes the word to his three fire team leaders, and then in turn we pass it to the three men with us, to our fire team. So tonight, I'm going to take the recorder up and pass the scoop that way. Next thing you'll hear will be the team leaders meeting with the squad leader, Sergeant Prince.
This mass attack that believes coming is coming here at this area. 2300 to 0400. There'll be an ambush going out, 3rd Platoon. Make sure your people know this. Pyrotechnics. Ski. Make sure you bring that red star.
Okay, we have it.
The red star will be in case we need assistance. We've got too much shit out there we can handle. We've got some loose radio contact. We use the red star.
Today's language, we were mobile. We did hold our position at times. We're on Operation Prairie. Matter of fact, on Operation Prairie is when I got hit, and just a couple of days later is when Mike was killed. I guess you could describe everything in one word in my imagination. It's ugly.
Was the Mike Company Philharmonic Orchestra, augmented by the HNS Company Pops Orchestra, with a breathtaking rendition of A Midsummer Night's Dream. For all you music lovers, that was done in the key of E5 to a tricky 7.62 tempo.
For the uninitiated, the key of E5, a Marine Corps sergeant is an E5. He said it was done to a tricky 7.62 tempo. Well, 7.62 was the caliber of the M14, and that was an attack he taped from a distance and then just added this narrative, which is what, you know, I have no idea where he came up with that.
Stay tuned now for the second portion of Music for the Quiet Hours. The rest of the tape here on this side are sounds recorded the same night of the meeting. I'll let you listen to the sounds as I recorded them when they called 100% alert, which is pretty rare. That is, we hope it's pretty rare up here. We don't know yet, right, Duff? Those were heat rounds, high explosive. Now the word's been passed to fix bayonets. Sarge just came running by and said, let me go get my bayonets. I can get hit on this. This started to be a fun tape. It's getting too much like a 12-cent combat comic book now.
It's always fun when you kill people.
Yeah. Now, there's all kinds of garbage going on. We don't know whether it's outgoing or incoming. No words passed down like that. The illumination is being kept up, and every once in a while a 60-millimeter mortar mission is called out to our left front whole mountain out there. In front of us looks like a 9-acre Christmas tree. Fire. Little Peter. High explosive. And the rain's just on time.
The attack that he taped was what they called a probe, and it was much like the, you know, going down the length of that finger, it was a tapered hill, and you could literally walk all the way down to the bottom on a gentle sloping trail. So what the NVA was trying to do was to break through our perimeter down there at the point of the finger, because if they could have gotten through that, then they could have charged up the hill. And if they break through that point, all of a sudden we're into literally a hand-to-hand, and it was a terrifying experience.
Everything's been quiet for about 15 minutes now. I was just crouching down in the hole there, talking to a hand grenade. I thought it was the microphone. I realized what I was doing. Sounds of the Enchanted Forest.
You're always scared. As much as you don't want to think about it, it's kind of a natural thing. You learn to accept it. You can't get rid of it. You learn to live with it. And even in today's life, it's still a frightening thing, and it's still there.
Well, there you go.
This was not Hollywood. At the other end of all that that you are listening to, people are really dying. You know, I don't want to think about that. But that is the reality. It wasn't a Hollywood soundtrack. There were real Marines shooting real bullets at real people.
Let's just hope we don't get picked for a reactionary squad. Look at all, Jesus. That's too close. There goes the 79.
That wasn't 79, really.
That wasn't either. Pepsi generation.
He had a penchant for telling his family everything that was going on. I mean, standing there taping a battle. I really kind of wanted my parents to think that we had had a Barbie set up on the coast of the South China Sea and we were grilling hamburgers every afternoon. I didn't want my parents to know what was going on.
to.
Yeah.
I'm sure that he wanted us to be able to see a mental photograph, and that was his way of communicating. So if he did inadvertently include way too much information, that was only his way of creating the entire picture for us as it really was in reality. He didn't want to hold back. As far as censorship is concerned, not that I'm aware of, did anyone listen to the tapes before they were mailed?
Have grenades in your pockets. We'll put them in your pockets in case we get called out. Called across there.
I don't believe the Postal Service would. And we always received the package and it was unopened. And it was direct.
Airstrike. Wiped napalm all over that place. Look at that.
I will assure you, I was not as calmly objective about what was going on as Mike was. This was dangerous. You know, this might be the night that I remember staring off down the side of that mountain looking for anything that moved.
If you thought twice about it, you had yourself a handful of troubles, so you couldn't think about it. You didn't like it, but there was nothing else you could do.
The way he calmly described all of that, it still boggles me a little bit. It's just unreal.
I got hold of some black silk PJs that I took single-handedly from a VC in hand-to-hand combat last week, right, Hope?
Now, this is to his 13-year-old sister.
I remember receiving the black pajamas, and I treasured them.
I guess I told you before, too, but I have those black pajamas for you that I got from a VCS, a Viet Cong suspect. And we found out later that he was a confirmed Viet Cong. So you have the real McCoy.
I'm sure she believed him. When I found Cookie in 1997, she gave me several things she'd sent home, including those silk pajamas. They're in real good shape.
I think he probably bought them somewhere or traded for them and created a wonderful story for his little sister. That's what I think. And I think that's wonderful.
Anybody who has handled those pajamas knows that they were not forcibly removed from a former living human being. No, he bought them, I think.
If you're between the ages of 18 and 22 and you've got the to join, don't be one of those unfortunates who suffer tragically from that malady sometimes referred to as Viet Cong yellow-striped fever. Stoop, stoop, stupefy your friends and maim your enemies. Exercise your God-given right to kill or maim at a distance. It's a great feeling to know that you can wipe out your entire neighborhood. Yes, be the first kid on your block to rule the world. See your Marine Corps recruiter today.
One of the things about being Mike's friend that was so much fun was to sit around and do these comedy skits. You could never tell when he would just pop into my fighting hole, sit down, turn on his tape recorder, and we would start to do the deals. And he started writing that Marine Corps commercial probably the first time in Dong Ha when he actually strapped on his cartridge belt, threw a bandolier of 50 caliber over one shoulder and a bandolier over the other shoulder, and they handed him a, you know, a bayonet and a M14 and a, and you know, six grenades around his whatever around his belt and everything else. And he probably the first time he got totally geared up to go out, he recognized how ludicrous it was that this very nice, pleasant guy who sang Colonel Von Trapp in The Sound of Music was standing there ready to absolutely take on the world. Mess with me. And Mike saw better than any of us how that kind of power can transform you. But man, that power was, it was seductive. Thousands of men, boys really, went to Vietnam, put on that same gear, and would not have caught that transition from driving your 57 Chevy through the drive-in to standing in Vietnam just loaded to the gills. And he caught it, and that's why he wrote that commercial.
Just sitting here listening to your tapes while we had breakfast.
Trying to straighten up, get ready for Thanksgiving. And I'm starting to get Daddy's lunch or dinner ready. He eats his dinner about 12 o'clock.
Yesterday, Mom took me to see Mary Poppins. And that was a really good movie. I enjoyed it very much. Take care of yourself and don't do anything I wouldn't do, as everybody in the school says. Bye, Terry.
They took my squad and wanted us to go down a hill because they saw activity on the other side, and they wanted us to do whatever. That was Thanksgiving morning, and I didn't get a chance to do it. A couple rounds came in and wiped us all out in that area. I think there was four of us that were wounded on that. From there, it was to the repos.
We left for a fairly extensive two-week operation. We didn't know where we went, and when we got there, we didn't know where we were, and we got back, we didn't know where we had been, because they just basically throw you on a helicopter, you fly 30 minutes, get off the helicopter, and there you are. Went out on operation, we were out a couple of weeks. We were up in the mountains, it was monsoon, we ran out of food, we were boiling roots and grass and weeds and eating weeds, green bananas, pineapples. On the 29th of November, we woke up in a valley out, I don't even know where, somewhere in the Kua Valley.
We must have just raised the colors that morning. I was in tech school. I was training to be a military policeman and went back to the barracks. And my commander stopped in and said, I have some bad news for you. And I'd thought that I was being transferred.
I was in history class, and someone from the front office came on the PA and said, is Lorraine Dickey in your class? Please tell her to go to her locker, get her things, she's going home. Very odd. Very wonderful. You know, who doesn't want to leave and go home in the middle of the day with the office permission? And as I walked to my locker, I began to imagine why I might be going home. What I concluded was that my brother Michael had come home, and I was very happy to go to my locker. In fact, I saw a neighbor on the way, and the neighbor said, what are you doing with your coat in your hand at this time of day? And I said, I'm going home. I think Mike's home.
Mike was walking point for the platoon, which was basically the first person in line. We were approaching or actually passing a Vietnamese village to our left. The village was deserted. When you walk past a Vietnamese village at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, there's absolutely not a soul in sight, something should trigger. And I heard a couple of shots. I heard, I think, perhaps one, as I remember it. And then I heard a follow-up shot, which we knew was an M14, so we assumed that Mike had fired back. One of the glitches here was that Mike did not have a selector on his M14, so he did not have his M14 on fully automatic. He turned and fired one shot from his M14, which didn't scatter the snipers, which gave them an opportunity to aim and take a second shot. And somebody said Mike was down. I ran to the left, and as I dropped into the position, assuming I'm struggling for words here right now. I've got the image of what I saw, but you drop into the prone position and get ready to assault. And I looked, and there was Mike on the ground. I had to go finish the skirmish, and we killed the two Viet Cong. I told Cookie that when I first met her. I was so proud. She didn't care. Wasn't going to bring her brother back. We had to set up a perimeter of security because they were going to bring in medevacs. And at this time, I thought Mike was only wounded. I looked over my shoulder, and four people had grabbed Mike, one each wrist and each ankle, and they were running across the field to the helicopter. And Mike's head was hanging loose, bouncing across the dirt. And I was looking at them, and I was getting angry with them for that, that they should be treating him more carefully. I started to stand up and shout at them. That's no way to treat a wounded man. And at some point, I just knew he wasn't wounded. I knew he was dead.
And lo and behold, he said, "Well, your brother was killed."
When I walked into the house, when I got out of Sandy's car and walked into the house, my mother was sitting in the kitchen. And looked as you would expect a mother to look who just lost a son in Vietnam. And I looked at her sorrow, and in my immaturity, I just kept walking and went to my bedroom and shut the door. My mother interpreted that as if I looked at her and thought, "It's all your fault." And she carried that burden for a long, long time.
So that was a pretty tough day.
With only a few feet of tape left, I think of 24 or so things that I could have said. I think about all of you and miss you so much every day. I wish that you could know somehow just how much and how often I do think about you. And how much I miss you.
Our corpsman, Dan Marino, told me that had Mike buttoned his flak jacket, he would not have been killed. That it was unbuttoned and open, and the bullet just, you know.
I think we both have had a shadow cast over us because of the same event. Tim and I connected, I think, the moment we saw one another, and that connection has remained. We both lost Michael. What that meant to our lives was very different. The hole it left in us was very different. But we've been able to be something to each other that filled that hole.
Whether I found Mike's family or not found Mike's family is all kind of superfluous to the fact that at some point I had to go to Mike's grave and tell him I loved him, thank him for being my friend, and close the circle.
I remember being here with my sister, who's 2 years older than me but blind, and so she's always been to me my little sister who I've taken care of, and leading her to the grave and guiding her hand so she could put a flower on the casket. I remember the 21-gun salute. It was an awfully grown-up experience for someone my age.
It's a long way from Vietnam, Ray.
Mm. Long way. A couple months older than what I was.
Can we tell him that he's been on the radio?
Yeah. He knows. He knows. I'm glad I've got my tapes where I've got his voice, because if I need to hear it, I'll listen to him. It helps today.
They had all this baggage that they hauled around for 36 years, and they were highly affected by this, making the ultimate sacrifice. Falls on the family also for perpetuity.
Well, I'm thinking about it. I don't know why I didn't mention it earlier. You just don't have any idea, Mom and Dad, Cookie, Sandy, and Terry, how good it was to hear your voices again. It was really wonderful. That's all I can say. What else can I say? It was really great to hear you all again.
Lance Corporal Baranowski's Vietnam was first broadcast in August 2003 and was produced